Welcome, Father. This is show number 75. 75.
Yeah, number 5 would be going way back.
We would go way, way back.
Yeah.
In our church history.
75. Wow.
75.
Great.
Yeah.
Is that
and
a diamond? Is that?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, no. Is it what? Yeah.
Yeah.
Diamond, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is.
50 is gold, 75 is diamond. All right. So,
wow.
We have been talking about the tumultuous, I guess.
Yes.
Battles and what's gone on in the history of the Israeli-Palestinian settlements, and what are we going to cover today with that?
Well, last time around we were talking about the Vatican policies, and we're going to continue talking about that today.
Okay.
I guess maybe a good way to start out with this would be something of a look at a visit by a Vatican official in 1980, in March of 1980, to Beirut in Lebanon. And this was Cardinal Cassaroli. And when he met with the Lebanese officials there, he assured them of the Vatican's great concern for what was going on there at the time, and promised them that the Vatican would do everything possible to maintain the territorial integrity of Lebanon. Remember that Lebanon is squeezed between the Syrians to the east and the Israelis to the south, but that the Vatican would do everything it could to maintain the territorial integrity of that country and also its national identity. Remember again that it's made up of many factions, three flavors of Muslims, the Sunni, the Shiite, and the Druze. Also, Christians themselves, Maronite Christians, and they were in the 1980s not of one accord either. Some of them following the president, some of them following the Falangist party, and so there's just great turmoil in all of that. And of course, Lebanon found itself in the unhappy position of being involved in a proxy war in which the Syrians and the Israelis were literally fighting each other through Lebanon. Mm. So that's unfortunate. On top of that, you also have Iranian interests in Lebanon, particularly with, for instance, the Hezbollah. And the reason for that was that the Iranians and the Iraqis were fighting. So on the one hand, the Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran is fighting a war, a very bitter, terrible war against Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an attempt to outmaneuver the Iraqis by getting into Lebanon and whipping up the Shiites of Lebanon. So it's just really an ugly, ugly thing. The response by the Christians in Lebanon to Cardinal Cassaroli was not terribly positive. Their response was this, that and I quote this, I think I quoted it the other day too, that the Vatican should understand, this is a direct quote, the Vatican should understand that Christians in Lebanon are not guinea pigs for the Christian-Islamic dialogue in the world. And this is something that the Vatican is always trying to do, is to bring about a better understanding between Christians and Muslims. A billion Catholics, mm-hmm. a billion Muslims. That's a big chunk of the world population. And to bring that together in a dialogue, as we had mentioned the other day, that that there are many things that Christians and Muslims share as an agenda item on the world stage. And one of those being pro-life and pro-family. And so seeing what we have in common is better than seeing what we have that separates us. And so Lebanon is seen by the Vatican as being an important sign of the possibilities of coming together. Unfortunately, it just wasn't going to happen. The civil war was spinning out of control. In 1982, Israel actually invaded southern Lebanon. The Vatican called for a ceasefire. It was absolutely ignored. There are massacres that take place. Two of the most notorious are massacres of Palestinians in two Palestinian camps in Lebanon. These are people, remember, that had been placed there in 1948, and now this is 1983, at Sabra and Shatila. Here you had Christian militias massacring Palestinian Muslims while the Israeli army sat by the side and watched it take place. And the general was Ariel Sharon. So, you know, that's why there's just an awful lot of long, long history. Well, the solution that the world came up with was to send in a multinational force to try to impose some kind of a peace on Lebanon. And there you had the United States, France, Italy, and the United Kingdom sent troops in. But in 1984, you have the bombing of the U.S. barracks, the Marine barracks at the airport, and the loss of several hundred U.S. Marines, one of the greatest terrible disasters, peacetime disasters, to the United States Marine Corps. And with that, the Reagan administration withdrew U.S. troops from Lebanon. Same thing also with the French. The French garrison had also been bombed just minutes before the Americans, and they also withdrew their force. And as a result of that, everything just pretty much fell apart. The winner in this is going to be the Ayatollah Khomeini. We're not really sure whether, there are a lot of smoking guns that point toward the Hezbollah being involved in this suicide bombing, and there's a lot of smoking guns pointing toward Iranian aid in bringing that off. The you know, from the Maronite point of view, they're looking at just survival, at just surviving through all of that. And so that's why, in the end, the militia threw their themselves over to the Israeli side. And so you had then Christian militia and the Israeli army there. And that continues on for a number of years. You also have another element in Lebanon. There's a general by the name of Michael Aoun. And he launches what he refers to as a war of liberation that's against both the Syrians and against the militia. So everything has just collapsed. And so what happens then is that the Lebanese parliament then met, but it was so dangerous that they couldn't even meet in Lebanon itself. The parliament was hosted in Saudi Arabia. And they received the backing of the Arab League at that point in what's known as the Taif Plan. And to show you the intensity of this, the patriarch in Beirut announced that he was backing the plan. This is the patriarch Sefer. And protesters broke into his residence, into the Episcopal residence, and beat him up.
Oh, my gosh.
He barely escaped with his life. John Paul II, in September of 1989, had a major address in which he called for peace, again outlining the Vatican vision of the Middle East and of Lebanon itself, that there would be coexistence between all the religious parties and political parties, that there would be protection of the weak and sovereignty to the nation of Lebanon itself. And in that address, the Pope said this. He said, "Lebanon is more than a country. It is a message of freedom and an example of pluralism for both the East and the West." And this is a very high ideal that he's holding up for the Lebanese. Unfortunately, the Lebanese themselves were not able to come up to that standard. It doesn't please a lot of Maronites. They were really hoping for a Vatican support. Where they will receive support, church support, is actually from American bishops. A number of bishops got involved. Cardinal Cook of New York paid two visits to Lebanon. And on one of those visits, he said the following, and he was speaking mainly to the Reagan administration on this. He said, "This is not a civil war, but an aggravation caused by Palestinian refugees. Solve this." And he's absolutely right. the only reason that Lebanon was collapsing was because those Palestinian refugees had been in those camps for so many years already, and, you know, for 30-something years, and it was breeding the one enemy in the Middle East, hopelessness, mm-hmm. and offering no hope. And so only by, and you know, once again, I think that Cardinal Cook put his finger on this thing. It's only by engendering hope that you're able to solve this this political problem. And so there, he calls upon the Reagan administration to get both Syria and Israel to withdraw from Lebanon, and then... this is important, to find a homeland for the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether that means an independent Palestine where they could return, or the right of return to return to wherever they were from, whether it be in Israel or Palestine, or a new homeland someplace, or whatever, that's the solution to this thing. And it just, obviously, it didn't happen. Also, Cardinal O'Connor picks up the mantle too, and carries that on. Cardinal Archbishop of New York also kept the pressure up. He had two visits also to Lebanon, both in 1986 and then in 1989. He provides, through the Archdiocese of New York, tremendous philanthropic aid to the refugees and to the Lebanese who are suffering through all of this. Ultimately, the Israelis, through internal politics, will give up on Lebanon. They'll withdraw their army across the border. That is seen, certainly by the Hezbollah, as a victory for them. That the Hezbollah forces had succeeded in beating the Israelis and forcing them to withdraw. That's probably carrying it too far, but you know, they're looking for any kind of good news, and for them that's good news. It's not good news for Lebanon. It just again leaves Lebanon in a vacuum. Now, vacuums are always filled, and the vacuum this time is filled by the Syrians.
Mm-hmm.
And the Syrians move in and basically take over, keeping Lebanon as a client state, which it is today.
A
client state.
A client.
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically, there's a puppet government that's dominated by the Syrians. The one good thing that comes out of it is that law and order has been restored to Lebanon. The Maronites are still split over what action to take, and right now the foreign policy concerning Lebanon, as far as the Vatican is concerned, is to try to bring reconciliation among the Maronites, and probably more important and even more difficult, a reconciliation between the Vatican and the Maronites,
mm-hmm.
because there's just so many hard feelings and a feeling that they had been let down, 20 years ago. So that's Lebanon, and, you know, it's just, it's sad.
It is sad.
But that's the world that we're dealing with, especially in the Middle East. It's just sad. When we look at the Israeli relations with the Vatican, it's even more tumultuous.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we just jump in on that?
Okay.
It looked as though there would be the possibility of a détente, of a loosening of tensions between the Vatican and the State of Israel in the mid-1960s. Remember, that the Israelis are very well aware of the fact that throughout much of the 20th century that the Vatican foreign policy had always called upon in the Middle East, their objectives was toward the protection of the holy sites and the protection of civil and human rights for everyone in that area, which meant usually a concern for the Palestinians because they're the ones who are being oppressed time after time. And so the Vatican and the Israelis are very well aware that their foreign policy or their policies vis-a-vis the Palestinians are quite different. There seemed to have been a thaw in that in 1964 when Pope Paul VI visited some of the holy sites itself, and in January of 1964 went to Megiddo, where he met with the president of Israel. Now remember that Israel has a head of state, a president that is a figurehead. I think I had misspoke myself a week or two ago mentioning that Ariel Sharon is presently the president. He's not he's the prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a government similar to the style of Great Britain. So the president is mainly ceremonial, but nonetheless, he met with the Pope, and so that was a big step. Later, the Vatican sent a thank you note to him. This is President Shazar. But here's the interesting thing. When they sent the thank you note, you know, it was nice of you to meet with the Holy Father and all that, they did not refer to him as president.
Mm.
And they sent the letter to Tel Aviv, not to Jerusalem. And these are diplomatic signs. These are very clear signs that there was no, at that time, the Vatican did not recognize the existence of the State of Israel as an independent country. And so, you know, you had that. There were still many questions and disagreements. One question was a question of taxation in Israel itself. Israel insisted on taxing all church property that was not specifically used for worship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the church is used to having lots of property that's not taxed. Monasteries are not taxed. Schools are not taxed. Hospitals are not taxed. Other land holdings that the church has for various reasons are traditionally not taxed. Israel wanted to tax everything that was not used specifically for worship, except for, in other words, just church buildings itself. So there's this constant disagreement in that. Added to that is the personalities. There are just a lot of very intense personalities in the Middle East. And there's some things that are, you know, quite honestly, you have to kind of blush and you go, what were you thinking when you did this? One of the big examples of that came in December of 1974 when the Greek Catholic Archbishop was pulled over. He was returning to Israel in his Mercedes-Benz. This is the Archbishop Hilarion Capucci. And he was pulled over by the Israelis, who then went ahead and searched his Mercedes. And they discovered small arms. He was, once again, you have to say, what are you thinking?
Mm-hmm.
He was smuggling arms in for the Al-Fatah movement. That's the PLO.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, you know, well, he was arrested. Ultimately, the Vatican negotiated his release. With that, he was then shipped out of the Middle East and sent as a papal legate to Latin America,
mm-hmm.
which would have been fine, except when the Latin patriarch, Monsignor Saba, was installed in 1987, who was there for the installation but none other than Archbishop Capucci. And it was such an insult to the Israelis that they returned the insult a year later when Yitzhak Shamir went to Rome. He visited with Italian governmental officials and did not even attempt to have an audience with the Pope. That was a slap in the face. So there are a lot of slaps and faces that go back and forth. Things actually begin to improve in the 1990s. In 1994, diplomatic ties were set between the Vatican and the State of Israel. There was an exchange of ambassadors. That doesn't mean that they're going to agree with each other on a lot. There's still great disagreement on especially human rights issues in Israel itself and in mm-hmm. the Palestinian territories. In October of 1997, a symposium was established at the Vatican to study the historical roots of anti-Semitism within Christianity. That's a big move, and this is so typical of the Holy Father anyway. John Paul II has always addressed big historical questions by establishing historical commissions and giving them the mandate to find out what really happened. You know, talk about a no-spin zone.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want any spin. He wants the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen this already concerning the question of massacres of millions and millions of Native Americans at the hands of the Spanish, and we find that there was nothing there for that. That's a myth. The trial of Galileo, we have gotten to the bottom of that. And this is yet another issue there. So that was an important step in both Catholic and Jewish and secular historians were involved in this study. In March of 1998, the Vatican issued an apology to Jews throughout the world for not having done more to help the Jews in the Second World War. Well, you know, we've already gone over that one. That's sort of a dead horse, but nonetheless, the Vatican issued that apology. In August of 1998, so just several months later, you come up with a fracas between the various factions and an organization called the International Jewish Committee on Interreligious Consultations. Then takes on the Vatican and disputes the Vatican policies, particularly concerning Pius XII and the possibility of his beatification. One of the Vatican officials, or one of the Vatican documents coming out in 1998, referred to Pius XII as being, and I quote here, a wise diplomat. I think if you look at his record and concerning the situation he was in and all the evidence, I think that you'd have to say that at the least. And yet this particular group condemned the Vatican for making that statement. In October of 1998, so just a couple months after that, Edith Stein had been canonized and religious leaders throughout Israel condemned the canonization of Edith Stein, you know, saying that they shouldn't do that because she was a Jew. Well, she was a nun. She was a Catholic nun. She was a convert. You know? So once again, I think you see that there's some irreconcilables here. In November of 1999, here you have a unfortunate situation taking place in Nazareth. You might remember this. In Nazareth itself, there was the question of giving a building permit to the Muslims to build a mosque right next to the Catholic holy site in Nazareth itself. And the Vatican got involved in that by condemning the Israelis for setting this thing up as a conflict between Christians and Muslims. In Nazareth, there's always been a pretty good relationship between Christians and Muslims, and both of them being Arabs. And this good feeling broke down. It ruined Christmas in 1999 in Nazareth, if you remember. In fact, Christmas hasn't been the same for several years.
Since then, yeah.
Yeah. There are just all kinds of difficulties. I had mentioned about Monsignor Sabah becoming the patriarch to the Palestinian Arab Christians in Nazareth. He is a very outspoken man. I mean, he calls the shots the way they are. And in 1990, when asked about the intifada that was underway, which is still underway, this is the second intifada, the uprising of the Palestinians, his response back was that it was caused by, in his own quote, by a strong man has pushed the weak one. And the weak one is now responding in kind. So very clearly, he's saying that the intifada itself has been caused by the heavy-handedness of the Israelis against the Palestinians. That went over like a lead balloon in the Israeli press, as you can well imagine. He also refers to the refugee camps as has having been transformed into huge human cages. They are pits of hopelessness. They breed hopelessness, and so he's putting his finger on that, but he's not being very diplomatic in doing that, and so you have that. Also, the Israelis will point to the fact that in 1982, when Yasser Arafat was openly and clearly defeated in Lebanon, and it looked as though his political career was at an end. I believe at this time he and his cronies fled to Tunisia. On the way, they met with Pope John Paul II, and that gave him new life politically. So the Israelis are also, condemning that. One of the most outspoken critics of the Vatican even-handedness in the Middle East is none other than our friend Menachem Begin, who said the following. This is a quote, and it's very clever the way he takes the myth of Pius XII and then folds that into the present. Listen to what he says. He says, "The Church, which did not say a word about the massacre of the Jews for 6 years in Europe, has little to say regarding the killing of Christians in Lebanon for 7 years, is now prepared to meet the man who has perpetuated the killings in Lebanon and who seeks the destruction of Israel in order to complete the work carried out by the Nazis in Germany." That is an incredibly conflated statement.
Very, yeah.
You know, it has no basis in reality, but this is the kind of venomous rhetoric.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. And so the sparring just continues on in Israel. I believe to this day that it is against the law in the state of Israel to manufacture a crucifix.
Really?
I was told this a number of years ago by a Jordanian, and I believe it's true, that over in Jordan there is at least one, maybe several, small factories that all they do, this is a Muslim country, what they do is they manufacture crucifixes, and then they import them over to Israel to the Christians there who are able to manufacture rosaries but are not allowed to manufacture the crucifix. And so then they're affixed at that time and then sold. There is a constant squabbling that goes on, even to this day, over the buying and selling of property everywhere in Israel concerning church property.
Mm-hmm.
And at every step of the way, the church is contested as it tries to just maintain its presence just by way of buildings.
Uh-huh.
You know, in March of 2000, you have the papal visit to Israel. It looks like there's some kind of a settling that's coming out. But in 2002, we all remember in the spring of 2002, the 39-day siege that took place at the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, and the heavy-handed atrocities that took place with that, the snipering down of the fellow who was a Muslim, who was the sexton of the Church of the Nativity. He was simply going to work one morning when an Israeli sniper took him out. You had the example that it's not very well known of the Christian Brothers community at the University of Bethlehem. This order was asked by John the 23rd to establish this university, and we've talked about the university already, but that particular community being awakened late at night by an Israeli commando group that came in and took over their residence to use it as a firing platform into the church itself. And the fact that the brothers themselves were locked up for days on end in this little room, one of them was even shot at, totally uncalled for. But it's that kind of heavy-handedness that you just see time after time in the relationship. So it's a stormy relationship. There was an article a little while ago that came out of an interview between with the former Israeli ambassador to the Vatican, a man by the name of Lamden, and he argued that after September 11th, that the Vatican policy has turned even colder toward Israel, And he argues that that there's a new initiative underway on the part of the Vatican to improve relations in the Muslim world. And as a result, the Vatican has again forgotten the Jews. And of course, he's a very he's also very intense and vitriolic about this. You know, adding fuel to that fire was a statement, an offhanded statement made by Cardinal Soldani at the time of the beginning of the Second Gulf War, just March a year ago, when someone asked him about the fact that the Vatican was not supporting the United States in its attack on Iraq. His offhanded comment was, well, is it really worth a billion Muslims? That was an unguarded statement, and you know, diplomats should always be guarded. But that adds more fuel to the fire of the Israeli point of view. They really have this concern. If you listen to Ambassador Lambden, a strong concern that the Vatican has turned its attention to the fate of Christians in the Muslim world, which is tenuous. You know, it's a very dangerous thing. The rise of Islam in Africa and in Asia, and particularly we have to think in terms of Nigeria. And thirdly, the rise of Islam in Europe. And that's what is demanding the attention of Vatican diplomats today. And as a result of that, Israel and Israeli-Vatican relations have been put on a back burner. If that's true, there's a lot of work to be done.
Right.
You know, I'd like to read a little selection. Oh, by the way, here's another book that I would really recommend. It's edited by Peter Kent and John Pollard, and the title of it is Papal Diplomacy in the Modern Age. And I don't have a copyright year on it, but it's quite recent. And it's a whole series of articles that I think would be of great interest to someone. It's
Kent and Pollard.
Kent and Pollard.
Okay.
And it's a Papal Diplomacy in the Modern Age. This is something that Jenkins talks about in his The Next Christendom.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about the tensions between Christians and Muslims. And it talks about the importance of solving this problem. He says the following. It's a rather long quote, so bear with me on this. He's talking about the slaughter of Christians and Muslims on both sides throughout mm-hmm. modern history, and he says this. These experiences remind us of the sad historical lesson that persecution can indeed be very effective if carried out with enough ruthlessness. Perhaps one cannot kill an idea, but it is not that difficult to massacre or convert everyone who holds or expresses it. Once the Nestorian Church was one of the largest and most widespread institutions in the world. By 1500, it had almost ceased to exist. Once, Turkey had a large Christian minority, but these were squeezed out of existence in a decade or two. These events provide a bleak precedent for modern minority populations. Undeniably, modern Christians have committed their share of atrocities. The Serbian massacre of Bosnian Muslims in Srebrenica in 1995 remains the largest single crime of its kind in post-1945 Europe. In recent years, though, the pattern of religious conflict has shifted decisively. In the world as a whole, there is no question that the threat of intolerance and persecution comes chiefly from the Islamic side of the equation. Around the world, Islamic states are passing through one of these historical phases of zeal and persecution of the sorts just mentioned. We can discuss at length why this extremism should be occurring. Over the past 20 years, the Muslim world has been caught up in a massive religious revival, and this movement has expressed itself in calls for pure religious states upheld by the full apparatus of Islamic law. That's the Sharia. Okay. Perhaps this idea appeals to people afraid of losing their cultural identity in the face of globalization. Or perhaps it might seem to offer a solution for the desperately poor in a world dominated by the wealthy and callous West. If these explanations are correct, then social trends are likely to lead to much greater support for Islamic extremism. That's not good news. According to the United States intelligence community, by as early as 2015, quote, in much of the Middle East, populations will be significantly larger, poorer, more urban, and more disillusioned. Mm. And matters still worse, growing still worse by 2050 or so. Looking at matters in social and economic terms does not mean that we should not take the demands of Islamic rule at face value and accept that the people generally believe that their faith really does require such political expression. But whatever the reasons, interreligious violence in the recent years tends to be initiated by Muslims against Christians, and that trend is unlikely to change. Now, interestingly enough, over this past weekend, there was a murder reported in the Netherlands, if you caught that or not, but it was a descendant of Vincent van Gogh. He was a filmmaker by the name of Theo van Gogh. He's a secularist. He was not particularly a Christian that I know of, but he has done a number of films, documentaries, showing the harsh treatment of women in Islamic countries. He was stabbed to death by a fanatical Muslim. That's just one example of so many of this fanaticism that seems to be, as President Bush refers to it, as hijacking a great and mm-hmm. ancient religion. I think there's just no doubt about that. And, you know, Bernard Lewis has talked about it in his book, especially What Went Wrong, that there's just this sense of frustration in the Islamic world and in the Arab world in particular. And I think we've spent, you know, several sessions talking about how in the 20th century that disillusionment and that frustration came about and what's fueling it.
Right.
Then we have to look at its expression, how it's being expressed.
And it's not a good way.
No.
It's not pretty, and it's downright scary, if you ask me.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that as we then move into, we're right at that point of taking a real hard look at the scorpion's nest.
Yeah.
You know, where this actually comes from, what's feeding this,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you can't live forever with hopelessness. You've got to find hope. Now, there's good hope and there's false hope.
Right.
And I really believe that that what's motivating the suicide bombers and the insurgents and all of the others that are causing such havoc in the world, they're being fed a false hope, and that this false hope is driving them to do this. So if you're ready, we can jump into a little bit of Islamic theology.
Okay.
The man who is so important in what's going on right now is a Muslim theologian, an Arab, living at the time. He's a contemporary with George Washington.
Okay.
Interesting. He has been compared to the Muslim equivalent of St. Thomas Aquinas.
Wow.
Because he's had that kind of influence on one particular brand of Islam. And constantly keep in mind that we're talking about a billion people, and they're very diverse. And religiously, they don't necessarily agree either, especially Sunnis and Shiites differ quite a bit. This man, his name is Ibn Abd al-Wahhab, okay? And he is born in 1703, dies in 1792, and he is a Puritan Islamist.
Okay.
That's important to keep in mind. He is also an ally to an emir living at the time in Saudi Arabia. Now, when we think about, or Arabia at the time wasn't called Saudi Arabia, but when you think about this, you know, we're going back to the 1700s. We're talking about the time of the War for American Independence, the French and Indian War, you know, the founding of St. Louis in 1764. This is all happening. You know, this is the age of Chouteau and Laclede and Louis XV and Louis XVI and, you know, just barely the French Revolution at the end of his death by the time he dies. But if you went into his world wouldn't reflect any of that. His world is medieval.
Okay.
He's living the same way that someone would have lived in the 13th century or 14th century in Arabia. And he's allied himself to one of the political leaders of the area there, the Emir Mohammed Ibn Saud, of the Saudis, you know. His theme is this, his theological theme is this, that it is important for Muslims to return Islam to its fundamentals, to the literal interpretation of the words of the Quran. That's their holy book. Okay, so what he's arguing is that Islam is, this is in the 18th century, Islam is watering down its faith and losing the favor of God in so doing. And so he calls upon all Muslims to return to Islam by returning to the words of the Quran itself. Now, the Quran is held in such high esteem with practicing Muslims. You know, we certainly have a high esteem for the Bible as Christians, and Jews have also. But there are things about the Quran that are held even in higher esteem. No one, for instance, Teresa, no Christian would argue that you cannot fully understand and allow the graces reading the Bible to affect you, that God speaks through the Bible, only if you read the Old Testament in Hebrew and the New Testament in Greek. No Christian would say, well, I have to learn Greek in order to read the New Testament. Now, certainly if you're a priest or a minister and you're going to be preaching, it's darn good to have a semester or two of New Testament Greek to
sure.
help parse out the words and all that. But no one would argue that in order to really understand, to let Christ speak to you, you have to do it in Greek. But, on the other hand, the Quran, although it's in every language, has been translated, it is only authoritative if it's read in Arabic.
Okay.
So to be a true Muslim, you have to read in Arabic. I remember a couple years ago talking to a young man, African-American, here in St. Louis, who had converted to Islam. And he was acting as a security guard. And so we got talking, and he was reading the Quran and talking a little bit about his conversion to that religion and some of the beautiful passages that are in there. In fact, if you read the Quran, much of it would inspire you to think that you were reading the Psalms mm-hmm. or one of the wisdom literatures. It has some very beautiful passages. But his point to me was, he said, you know, my goal in life is to learn Arabic so I could truly understand the words of the Quran. So it's held in such high esteem. And so when Al-Wahhab turns to Muslims and said, you have to learn Arabic and you have to allow the words of the Quran speak to you directly, literally. This is as strong and even stronger than Christian fundamentalism. It's even stronger than that because you have to do it in a particular language. Added to that then is an applied Islam. So that not only do you learn the words, but you also, and here's where it gets to be really interesting, you have to apply that to your life personally. Okay, don't have a problem with that. And this is the twist, that it must be, in order to have been done personally, it must be done societally also. In other words, the Quran speaks not only to the heart of the individual, but also to society. And so it's your responsibility to do by any means, to apply the Quran to society.
Okay.
The term in all of this is also another term we've become rather familiar with, is of jihad. Mm-hmm. And jihad is a holy war, but more than that, it is a struggle within the person to apply the word of God to your life and to restructure your life according to the words of the Quran. Now, Al-Wahhab goes beyond that and says that jihad includes taking that out of your own person and transforming society by whatever means necessary. He is drawing inspiration off of an earlier writer from the 1200s. And his name is Ibn Taymiyyah. This application to society is not just in a particular, like in a community, in a nomadic community in Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
He means for this to be done globally.
Mm-hmm.
And so the application of Islamic law, he sees then, is a globalization. We're to do this all over the world in what's referred to as the Dar al-Islam, literally the House of Islam, or the Islamic domain of shared meaning, is literally what that means. What this is a religious community that has certain common grounding. It's grounded in, that goes beyond, it's a religious community that goes beyond language, goes beyond ethnicity, goes beyond nationality. In a way that goes way beyond any kind of brotherhood or community of Christians. We used to refer to the Christian world as Christendom.
Mm-hmm.
This is what Jenkins is talking, that we're in the process of reestablishing that.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that ever since the coming in the late Middle Ages of nationalism, nation has meant more to us than our common religion.
Mm-hmm.
Catholics have fought with Catholics over
mm-hmm.
the centuries. That's a reality. Now, Al-Wahhab is arguing for a religious application of the House of Islam that goes beyond nationality, language, ethnicity, so that there is this incredible brotherhood. Okay, that's the idea, and basically, his preaching and his teaching stayed pretty much in Arabia throughout the next century or two. His writings have little effect on the rest of the Muslim world. That's true until the 1920s. Because in the 1920s, the Saud family begins getting incredible amounts of money from oil. These petrodollars then allow the Saudis then to proselytize this particular brand of Islamism. And this is a Sunni Islam. He's Sunni, he's not Shiite. So this is a Sunni Islam, and as I say, you have the spread of this. Remember that I mentioned that the Saudis were handed the area of Arabia, which is then named Saudi Arabia, basically by the British. In 1924 and 1925, the leader then in the Saudis then take over Saudi Arabia. This is celebrated by the Wahhabists in Saudi Arabia. They've come to power now, and they do this by staging riots all throughout Saudi Arabia, in which they went in and destroyed the tombs of the great imams, the great teachers and leaders of Shiite Islam, even to the point of one of the tombs of the daughter of Muhammad, Fatima.
Mm-hmm.
Her tomb was ransacked by the Wahhabists. These are purists. They're iconoclasts. They don't want any kind of picture, sign, any individual held in any high esteem. What then happens is what they do is substitute. Let me explain this. Muslims, like Christians, are pretty big into pilgrimages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, they like going to holy spots and praying, and they hold in high esteem their saints, you know, and just as Christians do. And the Wahhabists, on the other hand, are these purists who refute all of that, and are instead centered on simply the word itself. The fundamentalism of the Quran. And so what they did instead was they substituted the pilgrimages to holy sites and to martyrs and to saints' tombs. They substitute that sense of pilgrimages by encouraging the Hajj, which is a great pilgrimage that all Muslims want to try to make to Mecca and Medina. And in 1926, they sponsored the first worldwide Hajj to Mecca and Medina, and some 90,000 Muslims from throughout the world went. Today, as many as 2 million Muslims every year go to Mecca and Medina. I remember that just months after the fall of Afghanistan, the disruption of the Taliban,
mm-hmm.
that one of the very first things that Afghans who were in absolutely, you know, terrible poverty, and they'd just gone through this horrible, repressive Taliban regime, we'll talk about that a little bit later on, one of the first things they did was they chartered two planes to go to Mecca. You know, it means that much
mm-hmm.
To them. So, and as a result, the Saudi family has been elevated very high. One of their titles is the custodian of the two holy places.
Wow.
You know? So that in a nutshell, that's a little teaser for next time around when we come back, that we're going to see a revival of this this very harsh brand of Islam. We're going to see that it's supported by lots of oil money, and then we're going to see how it then applies the vision of Ibn Abd al-Wahhab to the 21st century by trying to bring about then this concept of the Dar al-Islam. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Wow. Okay, Father. Well, that's a kind of an interest. I hadn't known the history of the Islamic people either, and that the radical side came from Saudi Arabia then.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Because in most other cases, Muslims live very peacefully with Christians and Jews. They look upon all three religions as being religions of the Bible, grounded in the common tradition.
But doesn't some of the Quran come from the Bible?
Doesn't some of the
Quran?
Yeah, there are sections. It's sort of they sort of cherry pick.
Take pieces. Of
yeah.
It, right? They don't take like a
right. Yeah.
A whole book, but they take pieces.
Right. So they'll, you know, they'll look upon Jesus as being a one of the great prophets,
mm-hmm.
but the very concept of him being the Son of God, despite all the stuff that you have in the New Testament that acclaims this, they're going to deny that. They simply don't listen to those sections. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the Blessed Virgin. They have a high esteem. They see Mary as a saint. But the idea of calling her the Mother of God is, from their point of view, blasphemy.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're going to cherry-pick their way through the scriptures that we have.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we close today?
Okay. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be,
world without end. Amen. May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Father.
Okay.